What's your burning bush? Metaphorically speaking, of course. What brings you up in your tracks? Makes you stand open-mouthed at what is before you and think, wow. What compels you, at least in your imagination, to take the shoes from off your feet because you know that you are standing on holy ground? Well, for many people, not least some of the authors of the Bible, that holy ground is discovered in God's creation. I wonder if you engaged with the Baptist Union Environmental Network's display a few weeks ago. If you did, you may have found that the words and images brought you to a place of wonder and awe. One of the images in that display was this picture of a kingfisher. In one of his nature poems, the Victorian poet Gerard Manley Hopkins takes the image of a kingfisher taking off from water, and he writes of the kingfisher catching fire. Did that happen for you in that display? Or perhaps for you it is the night sky. Insofar as we are still able to see it with all the light pollution around, that may be something that causes you to think, wow. Or is it a mountain view, stunning in its aspect, something that reveals heaven to you? As another Victorian poet, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, observed, earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. And it was the same for the writers of the Psalms. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, their news no words, no sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. Psalm 19. Or, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is humankind that you are mindful of it? Human beings that you care for them? Psalm 8. The book of God's works can sometimes speak as loudly as the book of God's words. I think for myself, it's a mature tree in all the fresh greenness of early summer that causes me to think, wow. Just think about a tree. Trees are among the oldest living species on this planet. A single tree can live for hundreds of, sometimes thousands of years. A tree provides food and shelter for insects, birds, animals, and yes, human beings too. And it's been recently discovered that below the ground, where as much of the tree exists as above the ground, below the ground, through a series of fungal fibers, tree can communicate with tree, send messages. And when I take all that in, I think to myself, wow, isn't that amazing? And even more amazing that God imagined it right in the beginning. I take off my shoes before a tree. But the point I'm trying to make is that God can show up anywhere. You don't have to be in a special place like a church building or a service of worship for such an encounter to happen. For that's what it is, an encounter, a meeting with God. Consider Moses. He was not taking a holiday in an exotic wilderness landscape. He wasn't there because he liked being in the great outdoors. He was in the place of his work, for goodness sake. And actually a pretty demeaning work, because if you think about the stories of Joseph and David, task of looking after the sheep was given to the youngest and the least member of the family. Moses was looking after the sheep of his father-in-law, Jethro. He was at work. And God appeared to him. So what about your place of work? At home, in the garden, at the office, in the shop, at school or college, in the hospital, in the factory, wherever. Consider the possibility that while you're about your daily, maybe just humdrum tasks, that not only God may be with you, but that he may also disclose himself to you, meet you in a personal encounter, call you by name and invite you into a personal relationship with him, as he did with Moses. And maybe, as also with Moses, call you to a different way of serving him. The encounter with God. But if secondly, the story of Moses' call teaches us about where and how God may encounter us, it also teaches us about the compassion of God. If you were with us 2 weeks ago, you remember Nathan Toseland speaking of the way that God sees the misery of his oppressed people. He hears their cry, he shares their suffering, and says he will come to deliver them. Now that comes at the end of the second chapter of Exodus. And it's repeated just a few verses later in chapter 3. Now think, if Bible writers with limited supplies of parchment and ink could find the space and take the time to repeat something over again, that means that they are saying something really important. They are trying to draw our attention to it. They're saying to their readers, hey, look at this. This is something that you need to take note of it. We need to take notice of the fact that God has compassion for his creatures. And that God is compassionate towards his suffering children is not just something that's personal to us. Of course, it is that. God does indeed have compassion for us in our own need of rescue from whatever it is that we are suffering from, whether it be external circumstances or internal pain. God has compassion. We can know, each of us, that when and if we turn to God, he hears us, he understands our need, and he responds in the way that he knows that is best for us. But it's more than that. The story we read in Exodus speaks about what has been called God's preferential option for the poor. God has a special place in his heart for people, whoever they are, wherever they live, who suffer injustice and oppression, just as the Hebrew slaves in Egypt were suffering from injustice and oppression. Now, the African slaves in the Americas knew this. Their spiritual songs use the imagery of the Exodus story. And they knew that in their suffering, God was the only help that they could rely on. And indeed, God was at work to liberate them through the work of the abolitionists like William Wilberforce and the early Baptist missionaries in Jamaica. But even so, we have to admit that the legacy of the slave trade endures up to the present, and there's still unfinished business to be dealt with in that regard. But the real point I want to make now is that if God's heart is so directed to the suffering poor, then so must our hearts be so directed. We are called to display in our lives a likeness of God, to demonstrate his compassion. And that's why our support for BMS World Mission and Christian Aid, or Tear Fund, our response to the various emergency appeals that are issued from time to time, all that is why that is so important. It's just one way for us to share in God's heart to share in what God sees and hears and experiences and wishes to rescue. We cannot, we must not turn aside from the needs of the poor and suffering people in the world, because God does not turn away from them either. Now, thirdly, Exodus 3 has something to teach us about the name of God. Now, up to this point, God has and continues to be identified as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when Moses hears that, he is reminded that he can no longer consider himself as caught up in the individual particular circumstances of his life up to that point. He has a place within the bigger picture of God's plan of salvation for the whole world that began with God saying to Abraham, leave your city, leave your family, go to a land, a place that I will show you. Moses was in that tradition. That was the place that he had within God's purposes. The bigger picture of God's plan of salvation for the same world. And as I say, it's the same for us. We are still today part of that larger story about God's purposes and grace and love for humankind. And one of the reasons that Moses offers to wriggle out of obedience to God's call, his call to go and speak truth to power, is that the Hebrew slaves in Egypt will want to know who the God is who is sending Moses to them. And Moses doesn't know the answer to that question. So we ask God what his name is. What's in a name, we might ask? Well, we must realize that to the people of the Hebrews, a name was much more than a question of having ID with you, as we often have to have today. A name was much more than a mere tag or a label that helps to distinguish between different people, as it will be for us. In the Old Testament, the name reveals the person, the character. So you didn't give away your name too easily. To give it would have been to put yourself in the power of the person to whom you gave your name. And to know the name of another person implied that you had power over them, that in some way you were superior to them. So no wonder God seems reluctant to reveal his name. And even when he does, there is much that is mysterious about it. Eye, Asher, Eye in the Hebrew. I am who I am. Now, I am who I am is a translation of the Hebrew, has led over the centuries to endless philosophical speculation about the nature of reality or being with a capital B. Now, be reassured, I am not going to go into all that now. You can say, whew, glad of that. But I will say this, that if you turn the I into a he, so you get he is who he is. The Hebrew comes close to sounding something like Yahweh, the tetragrammaton, the four letters of the Hebrew name for God, the names that Jews are forbidden to pronounce. And yet, over the centuries, that name has been given the vowels that belong to the Hebrew word for Lord. And we end up with Jehovah. But as well as meaning I am who I am, the Hebrew could just as easily mean I will be the one whom you will discover me to be. I will be who I will be. I am the one who will go before you in front as a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. I will be the one whom you will meet, who rather meets us, as we go forward in faith towards the future that God has in store for us and for all creation. And the point is that God is free. That comes out of his name that he reveals to Moses. God is free. He cannot and will not be tied down. He does not conform to our notions of who God is and what we want God to be. He can never be within our grasp to be controlled by us. He will not allow himself to be manipulated by us. He is not at our beck and call to do what we want. No. It's the other way around. It is we who are always within God's grasp and are called to do his will. And that brings us to the final point I want to bring out of the scripture this morning, which is something about the call of God. I wonder if you noticed how at the burning bush, in the light of the suffering of the Hebrew slaves in Egypt, God tells Moses, I have seen, I have heard, I know, I have come down, I will bring them up. And then you might expect him to say, I will go to Pharaoh. But God doesn't say that. It's a surprise. And Moses would have been surprised. God says to Moses, I will send you. The risky, dangerous task of setting free the slaves is a mission that God entrusts to his human servants. And Moses, as we have heard, tries as much as he can to wriggle out of that commission. And we should not be surprised why Moses was reluctant. He's been asked to speak truth to power. His mission is to remind Pharaoh that he too is subject to a higher authority. A higher authority who commands him, let my people go. Now the king of Egypt was not used to receiving orders. He was the one who issued them. He was the one who must be obeyed. Through Moses, God says to Pharaoh, sovereignty belongs to me. And in the end, it is my will that will win out. Moses is risking everything to give that message to Pharaoh, even to his life. Now, we often try, I think, the same tactics as Moses to avoid having to accept God's commission and call. Moses says that he's not up to the task. Exodus 3:11. Who am I, says Moses? I'm a nobody. We might feel the same. But in reply, God says, I will be with you. And he promises Moses that he will presence himself alongside him. He will not leave us alone, abandoning us to get on in our own strength and out of our own resources. He, that is God, will undertake the crucial supporting role that we cannot do without. Moses' second excuse is one that I've already spoken about. The Hebrew slaves will want to know who the God is, who sent Moses, what God's name is. And I'm not going to repeat what I've already said. But just to say that, of course, it is harder for us because we have to reach people who don't even know that there is a God. And we have to show them, not so much by argument, but by through our life and deeds, that God is real. Anyway, quickly move on to the third excuse. Israel will not believe. Exodus 4:1. Moses answered, suppose they do not believe me or listen to me, but say Yahweh did not appear to you. And again, God offers Moses a means of convincing the skepticism of the slaves. Two signs. The staff turning into a snake, the hand withering and then being restored. Those soul signs might not be appropriate in the 21st century AD, but they would have worked in the 13th century BC. And I suppose we need to consider what signs there might be that would accompany our mission today. Would it be God's evidential blessing of our missionary endeavors? And yet God calls us to faithfulness, not necessarily to success. He does call us, however, to be faithful. And one of the questions I've given to the groups this week is to discuss what signs there might be that God is with us that would convince people of his reality and his goodness and grace. Moses' fourth excuse is that he is not eloquent in speech. He doesn't know how to put words together. Now, we might well think the same. But again, God being gracious, he provides a companion, Moses' brother Aaron, who has the gift of speaking fluently. And I suggest that the point for us is that God does not call us to work on our own, to serve him on our own. He calls us to work for him together in collaboration with others whom God also has called. Paul made it clear in 1 Corinthians. He said, while everyone has some gift to contribute, and we all have different gifts, yet no one has all the gifts. The various parts of the body need to work in harmony with one another. And that's something we need to remember when eventually we call a new minister to work with us. That person will not have all the gifts. Ours will still be needed. Now, lastly, in desperation, perhaps, Moses simply asked God to send someone else in his place. And this really seems to get God's goat. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. So in the end, all Moses' protests, all his excuses, all of them prove ineffective. God will not be put off. God has chosen Moses for this specific task of leading the Israelites out of slavery, and he will not be put off. Now, to finish, there's something, or better, someone missing from what I've been saying up to now. It's Jesus. Of course, no mere afterthought, but the fulfillment and the completion of the work that Moses began. Jesus is the one through whom we have an authentic encounter with the living God. The risen Christ has above all promised to meet us when we break bread together and share his cup around this table, as we shall be doing very shortly. This table isn't going to be an encounter with the risen Lord. Christ is also the embodiment of divine compassion. How often do we read in the Gospels that Jesus had compassion for the suffering people who crossed his path and who still cross his path? He is also the one who so intimately shares in the life and the being of God that he could dare to affirm before Abraham was, I am. And in addition, Jesus also gave us a new name for God, Abba. And finally, Jesus was so fully obedient to the call of God that he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, humbling himself even to death upon a cross, and risen again to life and glory, Jesus says to us, as the Father sent me, even so I send you. Go and make disciples, and remember, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. The wonder is that God can use even his reluctant servants. He can use us. In spite of our dodging and weaving and twisting, he can use us. But how much better it would be if, like St. Paul, we can say, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. Amen.